Even assuming that this motive force was sufficient, why did the lands of Europe, Siberia, and North America first move away from the original common land mass towards the equator and then retreat from the equator? In search of another moving force, Du Toit, a South African scientist, offered a variation of Wegener's theory, namely, a concept of an Earth in which the periodic, though variable, softening of the sub-crust through radioactive heating enables the skin to creep differentially over the core with consequent wrinkling. As for the mountains, not all of them are situated as long ridges parallel to the seacoast. And no compelling evidence has been brought to support the contention that ice ages were consecutive in various parts of the southern hemisphere and, in much more recent times, in various parts of the northern hemisphere. Furthermore, how explain signs of the recent ice age in the southern hemisphere? In Patagonia, New Zealand, and other places in the southern hemisphere, signs of recent glaciation are found. It is also certain that the chilling of the ice age was simultaneous all over the world. Coal is found not only in Arctic lands but also in Antarctics. Old, then, this continent traveled there from the tropics. And what was the motive force? If the theory is correct, the motion of the continents should be observable at present. Yet, though Wegener claimed, on the basis of certain reports, that Greenland and an island near its western coast still move, repeated observations and triangulations do not support this claim. Wegener perished on an expedition to Greenland in 1930. The assumption that ocean floors and continents are eternally different in structure is in contradiction to a great number of observations, though the land surface has been better explored than the bottom of the sea. The idea of a basic difference between the rocks of the ocean bottom and those of the continents is disproved wherever the fossiliferous contents of the land and of the ocean bed are examined. Marine expeditions have failed to find at various places on the ocean bottom the thick layers of sediment that should have been present if the sea had been covering the areas for untold centuries. On the other hand, sediments thousands and even tens of thousands of feet thick have been found on continents. Not only were large stretches of land in North America and Europe and Asia covered by the sea at various tunes in the past, and some well-investigated localities, like the gypsum beds of Pans, show repeated returns of the waters, but even the largest and highest mountain chains, the Alps, the Andes, the Himalayas, at some time were under the sea. Since the ocean once covered a vast expanse of land, it may at present occupy the place of former land. The land masses of today do not change their latitudes. The motive force claimed is insufficient by far. Coal beds in Antarctica and recent glaciation in temperate latitudes of the southern hemisphere all conspire to invalidate the theory of wandering continents. The changing orbit. The theory of sliding continents having been shown to be built on infirm foundations, there remain three theoretical changes in the position of the terrestrial globe or its shell in relation to the Sun that could cause great variations of climate: a change in the form of the orbit, or the path the Earth follows around the Sun, a change in the astronomical direction of the axis, a change in the position of the terrestrial shell in relation to the core, and thus in the position of the poles, sliding shell. At present, the elliptical form of the orbit changes by a very small amount. This could be the residue of a displacement the Earth suffered on its path, but following the principle of Laplace and Lagrange concerning the stability of the planetary system, this variation in the shape of the terrestrial orbit is considered to be an oscillation, the mean shape of the orbit being regarded as fixed. The period of this oscillation is supposed to be of very long duration. The obliquity of the ecliptic, or the angle which the plane of the equator makes with the plane of the Earth's orbit, is 23 degrees. This obliquity causes the sequence of the seasons. It changes now at the rate of 0.47 a year, but the limits of its variation are difficult to calculate. The figures offered by various mathematicians differ greatly. Lagrange estimated the angle of the swing to be as large as 7 degrees with a period that had its last maximum in the year 2167 before the present era. Stockwell calculated the angle of oscillation at less than 3 degrees, while Drayson estimated that the obliquity ranged from 35 degrees to 11 degrees, that is, a swing of 24. This variation, whatever its numerical value, could have been caused by a disturbance which the Earth suffered, but again, the cause being unidentified, the effect is considered to be a permanent oscillation. The Earth experiences the precession of the equinoxes, or a large spin of the axis with consequent displacement of the seasons in relation to the perihelion, the point on the orbit closest to the Sun. This precession or preceding of the vernal and autumnal equinoxes is as great as 50.2 in a year, and the terrestrial axis describes a wide circle in the sky in a period estimated at about 26,000 years. Newton explained this phenomenon, known since the days of Hipparchus, 120 BC, as produced by the attractive effect of the Sun and the Moon on the bulging part of the equator. But this explanation does not account for what in the first place caused the Earth's bulging part or equator to take the position under an angle to the plane of terrestrial revolution, or ecliptic. This swing of the terrestrial axis, as through the globe or atop disturbed in its motion, could also be caused by a disturbance in the motion of the Earth experienced sometime in the past. Finally, we have already spoken of the wobbling of the terrestrial axis, or its describing a small circle around the geographical pole, or, better, of the wandering of the pole that causes small variations in latitudes, discovered late in the 19th century. A theory that employed the changes in eccentricity of the orbit and the precession of the equinoxes to explain the variations of climate was advanced in 1864 by James Grohl, and accepted by Charles Darwin and others. It has since been abandoned, for it requires alternate glacial ages in the northern and southern hemispheres, and the evidence contradicts such an order of events. More recently, M. Milankovic introduced the third variable, the obliquity of the ecliptic, to correct some of the defects of Grohl's theory. In the opinion of his critics, however, his curve of climatic changes widely upsets geological dates, nor do his variables offer sufficiently effective reasons for the vigorous changes of climate. Besides, he assigned an arbitrary length to the oscillation period of obliquity. And why were there no ice ages during long periods in the past, if the process recurs at calculable intervals? Thus the inquiry turned once more to a more radical change, the displacement of the terrestrial crust in relation to the core, the rotating crust. The theory that the terrestrial crust is swimming on magma was first offered when J. H. Pratt, in the 1850s, found that the Himalayas, the largest massif on Earth, do not exert the expected gravitational pull and do not deflect a plumb line. Astronomer G. B. Airy was surprised, to the point of disbelief in fact, but then he offered a theory that the granite crust, much lighter than the magma underneath, is only 60 miles thick, and that under the mountains, on the inside of the crust, there are reversed mountains, immersed in the heavier magma, which would account for the lack of gravitational pull by mountains. This is the theory of isostasy. To the study of isostasy and its anomalies, gravitation is, strangely, stronger over deep seas. F. A. Venning Meyens, Dutch geophysicist and explorer of oceans, made many important contributions. He found in the very structure of the terrestrial crust signs of some violent displacements on a global scale. Thus it is not merely in order to explain the climates of the past that the dislocation of the crust is postulated. In 1943, Venning Meyens analyzed the stresses brought about by a change in position of the rigid Earth's crust with regard to the axis of rotation of the Earth. In this analysis, he surmised the crust to have the same thickness everywhere and to behave as an elastic body. He pointed out that if we assume that the crust happened to move clockwise in relation to the core by over 70 degrees, the expected effect shows a remarkable correlation to many major topographic features and also to the shearing patterns of large parts of the Earth's surface, as, for example, the North and South Atlantic, the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden, Africa, the Pacific, etc. If the correlation is not fortuitous, and this does not appear probable, we have to suppose that the Earth's crust at some moment of its history has indeed shifted with regard to the Earth's poles and that the crust has undergone a corresponding block shearing. However, according to the theory of isostasy, the crust is not of the same thickness everywhere. The crustal protuberances are immersed in a very thick and viscous magma, and for the crust to move, even if it is only 60 miles thick, would require a greater force than is available under prevailing conditions in the solar system or on the Earth itself. The very idea of a crust changing its position in relation to the axis of the interior, or of the globe itself, presupposes the validity of the theory of isostasy. This theory, though generally accepted, finds difficulty in explaining the propagation of seismic waves around the globe. If the Earth's crust is not just 60 miles thick, which, in relation to the volume of the magma, is as the thickness of the shell to the content of an egg, but 2,000 miles, as some scientists assume, then, of course, the displacement of the crust requires forces nearly as powerful as would the displacement of the entire globe, by inclining its axis into a new position in respect to the cardinal points of the sky. We are fully justified in concluding that the lithosphere was displaced during the Great Ice Ages, and that the displacements were the direct cause of the alterations in climates during these periods. The author of these lines, Pauli, propagates the idea offered, or revived, by the astronomer Eddington in his paper, The Borderland of Geology and Astronomy. According to Eddington, the ice ages were caused by the shifting of the Earth's outer crust over its interior as a result of tidal friction or the inequality of lunar pull on various layers of the Earth. This theory abandons every effort to find in the Earth itself the force that might cause the crust in its entirety to change its position in relation to the terrestrial axis, which, in this theory, maintains its astronomical direction. In order to pull the lithosphere, or crust, over the substratum, or core, a lesser force is required than that needed to incline the axis of the whole globe in some new direction, for the crust is but a portion of the entire mass of the Earth, and the momentum is dependent on the mass. However, in order to move the crust, preserving the axis of the core as that of the entire globe, the friction between the crust and the substratum must be overcome, and because of the equatorial bulge, in order to alter the position of the crust, it must be stretched in some parts. This would require the application of a great force, which does not appear to exist in tidal friction originating in the Moon. Furthermore, the tidal force acts on the surface of the Earth in an east-west direction, and a change in this direction would not disturb the position of the latitudes in relation to the pole and could not have been the cause of the ice ages. Eddington's theory requires the sliding of the crust northward and southward. To explain the origin of such sliding, he suggested that the crust, moving slowly in the east-west direction, upon meeting some excessive local friction between itself and the substratum, would change its course. But, as indicated above, the tidal friction of the Moon could hardly stretch the crust over the equatorial bulge. The theory of the sliding lithosphere shares the quantitative inadequacy of the theory of sliding continents. Some motive agent more powerful than tidal friction, Eddington, or gravitational differences at various latitudes, Wegener, or intermittent radioactivity in the Earth, due to it, must have been at work in order to move continents or the entire lithosphere. Thus these theories meet the fate of the earlier theory that postulated the shifting of the poles because of a geological redistribution of land and sea. Also the theory that would explain the displacement of the crust by an asymmetric growth of the polar ice caps is quantitatively indefensible. This theory uses the same phenomenon, the growing ice caps, as the cause and the effect of ice ages. The present survey of theories, which are quantitatively inadequate yet based on the well-reasoned principle of a change of latitudes or the direction of the axis as the cause of the ice ages, was here undertaken to make clear that thoughtful researchers among geologists, climatologists, and astronomers were unsatisfied with views that would not solve the problem of the geographical distribution of the ice cover in the past, a point of which almost all other theories are strangely oblivious. It follows, then, that the clamor heard at the publication of Worlds in Collision, even from some astronomers and geologists, to the effect that the shifting axis or changing latitudes had never been heard of, is not supported by scientific literature. W. B. Wright, of the Geological Survey of Great Britain, finds that the only way to explain ice ages is to assume that the Earth's axis of rotation has not always had the same position, and since it has now become obvious that geological history has witnessed many changes in the position of the climatic zones on the surface of the Earth and that at least one notable glaciation, that of the Permo, Carboniferous, preceding the time of the large reptiles, was due to a displacement of the pole from its present position, it becomes worthwhile to inquire whether the quaternary, recent, glaciation would not have a similar cause. But every inquiry in this direction, in Wright's opinion, failed to find a cause that would account for recurrent but not periodic ice ages. They did not return through geological history at measured intervals. Therefore, he concluded, among the theories that have been brought forward to account for the phenomena of the ice age, there is not a single one which meets the facts of the case in such a manner as to inspire confidence. Not only must the cause have been more powerful than the agents invoked, but it must have acted with great suddenness. On this we shall dwell in the following sections. Sudden the agent must have been, and violent, recurrent it must have been, but at highly erratic intervals, and it must have been of titanic power. Chapter 9, Axis Shifted. The displacement of the shell alone requires forces not in existence on the Earth itself, and the turning of the Earth's axis in a new direction requires more powerful forces still. Of course, one change does not preclude the other. Each would result in climatic revolution. If the crust moved, the latitudes would be displaced and, in an extreme case, the poles and the equator could change places, and if the axis turned in a new direction, seasons would change their order and intensity and, in an extreme case, a polar region could be turned for a large part of the year into the warmest place on the globe, being day and night under the direct rays of the sun, as presently is the case with Uranus. Harold Jeffreys asks in his book The Earth, has the inclination of the Earth's axis to the plane of its orbit varied during its history? And proceeds, the answer to this question is a definite yes. The theory of tidal friction assumes the equator and the plane of the Earth's and Moon's orbits to coincide. The fact is that they do not. The Moon, it is assumed, issued from the equatorial region of the Earth by the process of disruption and must, therefore, revolve in the plane of the terrestrial equator. But since it does not, there must have been a displacement either of the Moon or of the terrestrial axis, and the position of the Moon close to the plane of the ecliptic suggests that the terrestrial axis suffered displacement. Also, if from the beginning there was a difference in the direction of the axes of terrestrial rotation and lunar revolution, this difference must have disappeared as the result of tidal friction. Jeffreys considered the works of George Darwin, who tried to explain the observed positions by recourse to several additional tidal frictions, but he found a flaw in Darwin's hypothesis. Any internal changes in the Earth would be not important for the observed change in the direction of the terrestrial axis. Jeffreys says, if we consider the axis of the Earth's angular momentum, this can change in direction only through couples acting on the Earth from outside. The arguments of astronomers against the idea of the geologists concerning the change in the position of the terrestrial axis were correct only in showing that the terrestrial causes could not effectively displace the axis of the Earth, but the very fact of displacement is now claimed because of astronomical considerations and by such an authority in this field as Jeffreys. What could have played the role of couples, or of ice, acting from outside? And, again, was it a gradual change or a sudden displacement? Evaporating oceans. If we take into account the area occupied by ice in the glacial epoch, much larger than the area of the present polar ice, we must conclude that the shifting of the poles alone cannot explain the origin of the glacial cover. The expansion of the glacial cover in its various stages is supposed to be known. The usual estimate of its thickness is between 6 and 12,000 feet. From these figures the mass of the ice is calculated and the quantity of water necessary to produce it. The water must have come from the oceans. It is estimated that the surface of the oceans must have been at least 300 feet lower when the ice cover was developed. Some estimates double, triple, quadruple, and even increase sevenfold this figure. But for all the oceans to have evaporated to such an extent, turning many areas of the continental shelf, the sea at the coast to a depth of 100 fathoms, or 600 feet, into a desert of sand and shells, an enormous amount of heat was necessary. John Tyndall, a British physicist of the last century, wrote, "Some eminent men have thought, and some still think, that the reduction of temperature, during the glacial epoch, was due to a temporary diminution of solar radiation. Others have thought that, in its motion through space, our system may have traversed regions of low temperature, and that during its passage through these regions, the ancient glaciers were produced. Many of them seem to have overlooked the fact that the enormous extension of glaciers in bygone ages demonstrates, just as rigidly, the operation of heat as well as the action of cold. Cold, alone, will not produce glaciers." Tyndall then went on to demonstrate the amount of heat necessary to transport water to the polar regions in the form of snow. He calculated that for every pound of vapor produced, a quantity of heat is required sufficient to raise 5 pounds of cast iron to the melting point. Consequently, in order to evaporate the oceans and transform the water into aqueous clouds that would later descend as snow and turn to ice, a quantity of heat was needed that would raise to the melting point a mass of iron 5 times greater than the mass of the ice. Tyndall argued that the geologists should substitute the hot iron for the cold ice, and they would get an idea of the high temperature immediately preceding the ice age and the formation of the glacial cover. If this is so, then none of the theories offered in explanation of the ice age really would account for it. Even if the sun disappeared and the Earth lost its heat to cosmic space, there would be no ice age. The oceans and all the water would freeze, but there would be no ice formation on land. The importance of heat in the formation of the ice cover of the ice age was stressed even more by another author, an astronomer of our day, Menzel, of the Harvard Observatory. "Solar variability caused the ice ages. I should prefer to believe that increased warmth brought them on, whereas a diminution of heat caused them to stop. What could have brought about such a rise in the temperature of the oceans that, all over the globe, they evaporated enough to lower their surface not 3, not 30, but more than 300 feet? Could the heat have been generated by the decomposition of organic matter in the sediment? It goes without saying that this source would have been utterly inadequate. A tremendous heating process must have preceded the formation of the ice cover, and since it is generally maintained that there were at least 4 glacial periods in the recent ice age, in each of which the ice grew and then retreated in the interglacial stage, the globe, in a recent geological epoch, must have been repeatedly so hot that the portion of the heat the oceans received would have sufficed to turn an immense mountain of iron, 5 times the mass of the continental ice cover, to a white glow and melt it. According to Tyndall, if this did not happen, there could not have been any ice ages. Do we know under what circumstances the Earth and its oceans would be heated on a stupendous scale? If we subscribe to the ice age theory, we must assume that the terrestrial globe with its oceans was heated as in a furnace, in the age of man, since the ice age, together with the recent, is the age of man. Large stretches of the bottoms of the oceans must have bubbled with lava. But what could have produced this simultaneous activity of subterranean heat over such vast areas? We cannot imagine any cause or agent for this, unless it be an exogenous agent, an extraterrestrial cause. For the removal of the poles from their places, or the shifting of the axis, also, only an external agent could have been responsible. The adherents of the ice age theory must look to the celestial sphere for the causes of at least 4 separate encounters, in the not too distant past, with some celestial mass of matter or field of force. On passing through a large cloud of dust particles or meteorites, the Earth and its atmosphere would be heated by the direct impact of these bodies on its atmosphere, its oceans, its land. Under such an impact, a displacement of the poles or disturbance in axial rotation would also produce heat in every particle of a globe, because of the conversion of a portion of the energy of motion into heat. This is one theoretical possibility. The other possibility would be that, on passing through a cloud of dust carrying an electromagnetic charge, the Earth would react with electrical currents on its surface that would develop a thermal effect. If the earth passed through a strong field, the heat would be very intense. Selecting the better conducting strata, these currents would go through metal-bearing formations, possibly deeper in the crust, sparing life in some quarters and destroying it in others. Such heat could evaporate oceans to a great depth, cause the intrusion of igneous rock into sedimentary rock, start the flow of magma from fissures, and activate all volcanoes. The Earth is itself a large magnet. A charged cloud of dust or gases, moving in relation to the Earth, would be an electromagnet. An extraneous electromagnetic field that would produce a thermal effect on the Earth would also shift the terrestrial axis and change the rotational velocity of the Earth. This, in turn, would have a thermal effect, since the energy of motion would be converted into heat, and possibly into other forms of energy, electrical, magnetic, and chemical, as well as nuclear, with ensuing radioactivity, again with thermal effect. An extraneous mechanical or electromagnetic force would produce both phenomena, which are prerequisites of a glacial period, the astronomical or geographical shifting of the axis and the heating of the globe. The astronomers who oppose the theory of cosmic catastrophes must likewise reject the theory of the ice ages. Condensation. In the preceding section it was made clear that, for the ice cover of the glacial epoch to be formed, evaporation of the oceans on a large scale must have occurred. But evaporation of the oceans would not be enough, rapid and powerful condensation of the vapors must have followed. We need a condenser so powerful that this vapor, instead of falling in liquid showers to the earth, shall be so far reduced in temperature as to descend as snow. An unusual sequence of events was necessary. The oceans must have steamed and the vaporized water must have fallen as snow in latitudes of temperate climates. This sequence of heat and cold must have taken place in quick succession. A precipitate drop in temperature and a rapid condensation of vapors could have followed from the screening effect of clouds of dust, oust of either volcanic or meteoric origin, by enveloping the Earth, could have impaired the solar light and warmth reaching the lower atmosphere. The dust particles ejected by erupting volcanoes have been observed to float in the sky around the globe for many months. So, after the eruption of Krakatoa in Sunda Strait between Java and Sumatra in 1883, dust particles suspended in the atmosphere continued for over a year to act as a screen around the world that caused the sunsets to be unusually colorful. Dust from many volcanoes could build a screen that would obstruct the solar light. Actually, the screening of the Earth by clouds of dust of volcanic origin was one of the theories concerning the origin of ice in the glacial epochs. However, like heat alone, cold alone would not have sufficed to produce the continental ice covers. In the struggle between heat and cold, snow would descend in some parts of the world and torrential rains in others. And, in fact, numerous scientists who conducted their field study in various areas outside the former ice cover came to the conclusion that those areas had experienced periods of torrential rains that were simultaneous with the glacial periods in higher latitudes. Gregory, studying the African continent, observed signs of water action on a great scale at the same time that other areas were being covered by advancing ice. 8. There remained in the Sahara and adjacent region stream channels not now occupied by water courses that obviously carried great quantities of water. It is believed probable that these streamways were trenched during a pluvial age or pluvial ages. In the pluvial, Lake Victoria in Africa stood over 300 feet above its present level. Since that tune there was a complete reversal of the river system in the region. Shaw Gull, a salt lake in Sinkiang, had its level 350 feet higher than it is today. Lake Bonneville, which occupied parts of Utah, Nevada, and Idaho, and collected pluvial water as well as melt water from the local glaciers in the mountains, stood more than 1,000 feet above the present Great Salt Lake. Although some geologists, on theoretical grounds, would prefer to think that a dry climate prevailed in the world when so much water was concentrated in the ice covers, field geology shows the opposite to have been the case. Snow fell in huge masses, and rain cascaded from the sky at the very same time. A working hypothesis. Let us assume, as a working hypothesis, that under the impact of the force or the influence of an agent, and the Earth does not travel in an empty universe, the axis of the Earth shifted or tilted. At that moment, an earthquake would make the globe shudder. Air and water would continue to move through inertia, hurricanes would sweep the Earth and the seas would rush over continents, carrying gravel and sand and marine animals, and casting them on the land. Heat would be developed, rocks would melt, volcanoes would erupt, lava would flow from fissures in the ruptured ground and cover vast areas.